This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Layering caches is retaining. Events which is reported in the center from two different perceptions. Perception of Moshe Rabbeinu, perception of the Mishnah. They yield opposite results. Moshe Rabbeinu, after relating to Klal Yisrael the events at Har Sinai, they're still in the Mount Sinai, and he says to them as follows. ויהי כשום אחר אסכו מתוך הקושי כל בואי ובאש. Was you heard a voice from inside the darkness of the mountain burning fire? ותקרבון אליי, and you drew near to me, you sent a delegation to me. כל ראשי שבטיכם וזכמיכם, all the elders of your tribes and your all the heads of your tribes and your elders. That's what you say. Ein her ono Hashem v'kiyem es kvedu es kodlo. Hold Hashem has shown us His honor and His greatness es kvedu es shumani v'tuch v'ish. With His own voice, the voice of Hashem is what we have all heard from the midst of fire. It's been an unbelievable experience. Hayim hazeiro inu ki yedaber elokim es olam b'chor. For the first time we have realized today that the Ribbono shel Olam can speak to a human being and can survive. We didn't know that that was possible for a living human being to achieve such heights. You know, if we don't have bodies, if we could release our souls of the burdens of our bodies, then we can communicate with the Ribbono. But that we can remain living human beings, ordinary human beings with ordinary bodies and ordinary feelings and ordinary emotions, and communicate directly with the Ribbono Shel Olam, that we didn't know was possible. And we've seen today it is possible. The Ato Lama Numus, that's why should we die? This immense fire will consume us. If we continue to hear Hashem's voice, we will surely die. Klal Yisrael are saying, we don't feel capable of maintaining a level which justifies the Ribbono Shel Olam addressing us directly. And if He continues to address us directly and we don't maintain that level, we're going to be destroyed. We're not going to survive. Ki mi kol bosor asher shoma kol elokim chayim adabe mitzvei flesh kamoim v'vayim. Where is there such living flesh that hears the voice of Hashem talking and remains from the midst of the fire like we have and remains living? Where does one hear of such a thing? It's not possible to have such a thing. And therefore we cannot expect to maintain a level which will enable us to continue to survive such exposure to the Ribbono Shel Olam's direct communication. Karav ato usham. You go and listen to the Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam. You, Moshe, we would like you to go up to the mountain. You learn the Torah. Is kol asher yomer Hashem elokim. You listen to every word that Hashem has to say. We at tadaber eleinu es kol asher yedaber Hashem elokim elecho. And you report to us everything which the Ribbono Shel Olam has talked to you, and Shomanu Vosuda, and we will study it and we will hear it. So that we're not trying to get out of anything, all we want is our own survival. But we can survive this continued exposure to the Ribbono Shel Olam's direct communication. And therefore we appeal to you to be the one to do it. You can. You're already detached from this world. Moshe Rabbeinu, you're living on a different spiritual level. You can survive such communication. We can't. So why don't you learn directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam? You teach us, whatever you teach us, we will keep and we will do. And the Sikuno adds that they're saying this, Afal pi shiye diburcho gorua be'erech el hadibur ha'elukim. Even though we know that your communication must be inadequate compared to the Ribbono Shel Olam, we don't expect to get it first time. We don't expect to get it with the same degree of purity as we could get it from the Ribbono Shel Olam. We know we're going to have to sacrifice perfection. But for our survival, we need that. It's necessary. altogether this interesting concept in their request. And that is a realization that accommodation is necessary for the development of the individual and for the maintenance of the individual. If we were angels, then there would be no accommodation necessary. The Torah could be applied in its strictest and purest form. There would be no difficulty, there would be no problem. But the whole area of the oral law, the whole area of the Torah Shebaal Peh, is there to make the Torah workable in a world which isn't perfect. Why should it be necessary for the Torah to say that you're not allowed to write on Shabbos, and for the Chachamim to say you can't touch a pencil, you can't move a pencil on the mind? Why should that be necessary? If we know you're not allowed to write, surely that's enough. The Chachamim know human nature. They know it's not enough. Therefore we have the concept of the Dorim, slowly various different things have to be done in order to make the Torah workable in an inadequate world, in an imperfect world. We spoke earlier at the Shalshudas about the importance of spiritual maturity and religious maturity. Part of religious maturity is the recognition that in order to achieve perfection, accommodation is necessary. You cannot start with an objective perfection and expect to get there immediately if there isn't subject to perfection as well. If the subject is perfect, then it can relate to an object that is perfect. If the subject is imperfect, it needs a certain dilution in order to be able to relate to an object which is perfect. Sometimes the thing can be too concentrated for us. It's to be diluted. Not because it is inadequate, but we are inadequate. We can't handle it in its purest form. And that's something, that's spiritual maturity. You have, for example, certain people can't find shidduchim. There are all different reasons as to why certain people can't find shidduchim. One of the reasons is, as I'm sure many of you come across, is people for a perfect match. Now, people are entitled to a perfect match, but they don't know what a perfect match means. By perfect match, most of them mean a perfect person. So the man is looking for a perfect girl, the girl is looking for a perfect man. They remain bachelors for a long time. And spinsters. Why? The simple reason is that if there existed such a thing as a perfect man, he wouldn't be interested in that girl. And if there existed such a thing as a perfect girl, she would not be interested in that. So the person they are looking for, by definition, couldn't possibly be interested in the shoe of wood. But what does a perfect man mean? A perfect man means I've been looking for somebody imperfect. For somebody perfect wouldn't want me. But I've got to look for somebody who's imperfect in a different way to me. So that the two of us together can make a perfect match. A perfect match is two imperfect people coming together to make something which is perfect. Then you've got perfection. So one has to realize that in the development, in the achievement of perfection, there must be imperfection. One of the biggest dangers, by the way, in some of these cases, is appearance. Sometimes you've got a situation where case at the moment, it sees where the mother has just destroyed the young man's, he's about to take the engagement, he's about his 11th, 12th serious involvement, but he's about to take the engagement, he's finally been broken up maybe a short while before he's ready, because nobody's good enough for the mother. And that's a very dangerous situation. Boy, it's easier because nobody's good enough for the boy, that's true, but he meets a young girl and he finds good, so she's not perfect, but I feel good with her. But the mother doesn't have that feeling. She's just looking for objective perfection. This girl is not perfect. She's not perfect, she's not good for my, not good enough for my little kid. We need somebody better than this. Nobody good enough. But there are opposite dangers too. Sometimes one feels perfect and it's a false emotion. A nice Yiddish boy goes out with a non-Jewish girl and he feels perfect, feels comfortable, I don't know why. It's also not right. There has to be a certain, and that's where the maturity comes in. There have to be certain objective qualifications to make the thing work. And then They have to be not compromised, but accommodation. And then imperfections can work together. It's part of immaturity to demand perfection and to settle for nothing but perfection, and in so doing to destroy oneself. It's part of the way. But perfectionism is an illness. Perfectionism is an excuse to do nothing. If it's not perfect, I'm not doing it. Did you know it won't be perfect? This I'm not doing it. And you'll attack it. Why am I not doing it? Not because I'm lazy, because it can't be perfect. It's an illness, it's an obsession. On the other hand, there has to be a striving for perfection, for excellence. There has to be all part of maturity. The understanding that perfection is created out of imperfection. Perfection is not created out of perfection. We have to take imperfect things, and by synthesizing them, and melding them, and blending them together, we create perfection. We create all different types of perfection, all different forms of perfection. And Israel realized that. And Israel realized it's all very well to say that perfect would be if we could hear the Torah directly from the Rebbe Mishnah. That would be perfect. But it's not practical. We're not going to be able to stick it out. We're risking our lives. We're playing with fire, literally. If we aim for perfection and we miss, we've got nothing. And that's part of the danger of perfectionism. This immature approach to perfectionism. Because if you aim for perfection and you miss, you've got nothing. I think it was in the last year we spoke about self-image. And the importance of setting goals for a child and for oneself that are achievable. Because to set the goal which is not achievable must shatter self-image. Can't build up self-confidence. And that's what part of what the perfectionist suffers. You will very often find perfectionism and paranoia going in the same person. Because there's a lack of self-image. He stands to perfection so high that he never achieves them. Since he never achieves them, he feels he's inadequate. And a person who feels he's inadequate convinces everybody else also feels that they're inadequate. And therefore he feels threatened by everybody else. So very often you'll find perfectionism and paranoia go together. One picks it up very easily in pathology, by the way, very easily. It's time to know what's going to be. And Israel say we want perfection, but our route to perfection has to be a little bit round and about. We can't take the straight route to perfection, because if we do miss, then we're in trouble. Then we're dead. One cannot survive on anything but the highest level. We would have to be on such a high level to survive with perfection. Today, it's like a different sphere, it's like a different form, and that is the tendency to see achievements in the object rather than the subject. This comes to a large extent from our material background. How do you measure a person's success? In material society, you measure the success by what he possesses, by how much he earns, by what he earns. That's your measure of his success. That's the only measure that we have in success. And that is infiltrated. One sees it a lot more in the States than one sees it here. For example, in America, a doctor doesn't have patients anymore. He has clients. In some places, customers. He doesn't have a surgery. He has an office. He runs a business. Understood quite clearly that it is so. And he goes on courses of business administration, and he runs his practice strictly as a business, which in a sense is fair enough, he's got an end of living. But then it goes a step further. He'll say to somebody, is so-and-so a good doctor? That's true, yeah, sure, he earns 200,000 a year. And 200,000, of course, is a good doctor. The measurement is in a material sense, in an objective sense. I mentioned to you once when we churn around the palace of Versailles, France, fire. A very naive and sweet French guy was taking us around from room to room and was describing the treasures, the art treasures of the painting, what they are, what they meant, and their background, their history, where they came from. That's fascinating. And he was an American, feeling the bias, he was getting increasingly impatient. As we came into a new room, he came up, this is the first few words the guy had said, and he said, yes, I'm going to go, yes, I'm going to go, and he went to the next one. listen for 2 seconds, and he was done. Eventually, he couldn't contain himself. He says to this French guy, hardly speaking English, tell me, how much does this whole place cost? What is it worth? And she looked at him, and she couldn't understand the question. It was just a total gap in communication. She didn't understand what he was asking, and he couldn't understand why she couldn't put a value to it. Surely everything has a price. If I were to make an offer, what offer would be accepted? And she was totally, totally baffled. And so I said to her, you mustn't be baffled. All he's asking is, he doesn't understand how to value. He doesn't have a means of value. He doesn't understand art. He doesn't understand culture. He has no other ways. An American businessman whose only training is in quantification. He measures whether a doctor is a good doctor or not by how much he earns. And he measures whether a work of art is a good work of art or a bad work of art by how much it costs. And that's why you find these works of art are now being auctioned with untold fortunes. Because that's a sign that it must be good. They're only too pleased to pay a lot of money for it, because if they're going to own it, they want to be able to say, I paid $3 million for it. Otherwise, the fact that it's a Van Gogh is not why it's good. It's good because I paid $3 million for it. So they're only too happy to pay $3 million for something which has never before been sold for more than $100,000. Doesn't make any difference. That's its value. That gives it its value. So I said to her, don't worry about the question. All he's asking is, how can he value it? What does it mean to him? You've got to find some way of explaining to him what it's worth in terms that he can understand. But that's all part of our tendency to measure things by quantifying an object rather by looking at the subject. I spoke to the Shalashudas about attaching labels to people and judging them by labels instead of judging them by their qualities, and how dangerous that is, and what that leads to, and what total misjudgment that leads to. Why you find people who are happier to have sitting at their table a Shomer Shabbos who learns Torah than is a Leitz, is a cynic, is a negative, destructive human being, they feel more comfortable than having a person who is an intellectual, who can't, who doesn't have an education, who doesn't have shabbat, doesn't know from. But he's an intellectual person, a sincere, he has intellectual integrity, a validity, sense, he questions, he asks. They feel more comfortable with the first than with the second. Why? Because the first one is more like me. Why is he like me? Because he's also from. He also keeps Shabbos. He also sends his children to and from school. He also learns Torah. Therefore, we are the same. This person over here is not the same, because he does not send his children to a from school, and he does not keep Shabbos. Therefore, we are distant. We are far from one another. That's not so. On the surface, you're far from one another, but if you look at each other a little bit more deeply, you might be much closer to the second one, to the first one. The first one is a late, the first one's a cynic, the second one is a fine, constructive human being. The first one is an arrogant person, the second one is a modest person. The first one is a Balmidas, the second one is not. The second one's a Balmidas, the first one is not. The first one has not got a questioning mind, the second one does have a questioning mind. The first one is not an intellectual, the second one is an intellectual. One has to look at deeper qualifications in the subject, not in the object. And it comes also in the area of Yiddishkeit and Frumkeit, where there is an attempt to seek perfection in the object. That's what we're facing today. I want to be perfect, so what do I do? My lulav and esrog must be the best of any. That's a wonderful thing. That's a hiddur in the mitzvah of a in a mitzvah where hiddur is very important, provided it's in its right perspective. And I want my meat to be the most kosher. If there are different shchitas, I will take the best no matter what the cost. I will take the most expensive, the best shchita, which is at the highest standard that day. And I will send my children only to the best of schools. And each thing absolutely top. All that is fine, provided it's one angle of the totality of what Jewish is. But where one begins to feel one's entire perfection in the object, then we're into Christianity, we're not going to tell you. That's Christianity. Where the ritual is something outside of the individual, that has to be followed perfectly, and then you're at home. You're within you want. It makes no difference as long as you accept so and so, believe in him, go and live whatever kind of miserable life you want, and the ritual is complete. Tendency right within the firm circles of Yiddishkeit sometimes to be affected by current social pressures and social norms. Don't think that we're protected from it. Western materialism and Western Christian beliefs penetrate right into the depths of firm Yiddishkeit as well. And we find ourselves trying to seek perfection in perfect objects. That's not where perfection lies. Perfection doesn't even lie in the perfect subject. It's the inside of us. Actually, yes, there's such thing. So where are we going to find perfection? The object, that's Christianity. That's utterly dissolved. What is our goal? Create a perfect object. That's our goal. That was Christianity. Make a man who was perfect. There is no righteous man, says David HaMelech, who lives upon this earth and does good and does not sin. There is no such thing. Say the Christians, let's make one. If there isn't one, we'll make one. A man who never sinned, who never did anything wrong, a son of God. There he is. You can point at him. That's perfection. You don't believe in such a thing. You can't point at perfection. Because the only perfection is the Ribbono Shel Olam, and you can't point at him. So we're dealing with imperfections. That's part of maturity. So where can I seek some degree of perfection? Only in one area. The relationship between the subject and the object. That. I can't be perfect. And the object is not meant to be perfect. My relationship to the object can be perfect. That's where the human being can reach a level of perfection, discover a level of perfection, and improve himself. Klal Yisrael say to Moshe Rabbeinu, we realize that the Ribbono Shel Olam is perfect. And if we were perfect too, we would simply listen to him teaching us to be. We're not perfect. We've managed to keep it for a few moments to listen to the Aseres HaDibros, that's fine. The Ten Commandments we heard, and that was it. We managed to keep ourselves on that level. But it's not going to last. And if we're imperfect, then our only way of reaching perfection is going to be to relate to something which is also a little imperfect. We want you, Moshe, we know, as the Sikunu says, Apa Pishiye Diburcho Gurua, we know that your teaching is going to be less perfect than the Ribbono Shel Olam's. It's not going to be the Ribbono Shel Olam's perfection. That doesn't matter. That's what we need at this point in our lives. We need the imperfection to create or to lead us to ultimate perfection. Says Moshe, Afishma Hashem is called. And Hashem listened to the voice of the words. Listen to what Moshe says. He doesn't say, Vayishma Hashem El Direch. Hashem listened to your words. Vayishma Hashem El Kol Direch. Listen to the tone of the voice. Listen to the underlying meaning. He penetrated to the depths of what you were really saying. The Daber Chem Eloi, when you spoke to me. Vayomer Hashem Elai, and Hashem said to me, Shomati es kol divrei ha'anazeh. Again he says, I have listened to the voice of the words of these people. I have listened to the underlying meaning of what they're saying, Asher Dibrei Lecha, which they've spoken to you. Heitivu kol Asher Dibreiru. Everything they've said is good. Miyitin bo yonavavon zeloim lehiroisi. If only they were able to remain on this level of fear of Yira of me, the Lishma is called mitzvah, I call you to keep my mitzvahs all the days. Leman hitov lo yivu livneim lo ilom, so it will be good for them and their sons all the time. They have understood something of great value, if only they would always retain that. They are worried about the danger of striving for perfection in the object when there is no perfection in the subject. They realize that it would all be very well in theory to relate to the Ribbono Shel Olam directly, that is the absolute, that's where it should be. But they realize that the facts are they're not going to be there. If they strive for something beyond them, they'll finish. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, I hope they always stay there. You can always remember them and operate them. The Ribbono Shel Olam gives his stamp of approval to this approach of Klal Yisrael. Area again, back to the spiritual maturity. This is so mature. Klal Yisrael, so mature. And have this understanding. And it requires such maturity to understand and to appreciate it. And something which, as I mentioned at the Shalashud, as we missed today, because while we have maturity in other areas of our lives, we're intellectually mature and we're emotionally mature, religiously we're not mature. Because religious maturity comes from generation. Religious maturity comes from the service. Where does one pick up maturity from? From imitating the parents. That's how you become mature. If you raise the child without any exposure to adults, they might well remain children. I would imagine they might well remain children. The pressure of an adult environment creates maturity. Interesting dispute among educationalists whether it's correct in your home to make furniture, to adjust the furniture to the size of the children. the chairs and tables, and make the door handles lower down so you can make the clay walls themselves, and the light switches, bring them all down to the level of the children. And there was a school of thought that said, yes, you must bring your child up in a hostile world, things against him, you can't do anything, you're creating all sorts of barriers for him and so on. But the prevailing view was, no, the child has to realize he's getting to adjust to an adult world, and he is a child, and his growing process is the process of growing till he can reach that door handle, and the thrill of finally reaching the door handle, that's part of his education. That applies not only with door handles, but it applies with general emotional maturity. The child is put into a situation of pressure by adult behavior, and the adult behavior demands of him to mature, and thereby he develops his maturity. We don't have, our generation of Bali Tshuva don't have parents, and therefore they have no adult Yiddishkeit. Their only exposure to Yiddishkeit has been from peers who are children like themselves. And therefore we have a whole generation who is growing up as religious hippies. And the children never grew up. The children never matured. They came much later on. That same concept today is a religious maturity in our approach to oppression, to overcome, to battle with it. We don't have the source for it. That's the magic of surviving to the importance of Europe prevailing of the rob of the town, being the one to whom people used to bring their children just to see him. And how much more important that was, he said to me, than all the four parts of the Shulchanot. This part, we can call it for that, seeing the tzaddik. In those days, every world, every little town, it's the same God of Israel, every little town, and the most outstanding world, tzaddik in his midrash, is a chokhmah of the highest order, his learning. And the parents used to take, whenever they used to go for a shiloh, they used to take the children with them, to see, this was the dus, this was the hero. You see, the children do attach themselves to heroes. Unfortunately, nowadays the heroes are often scanning television characters. That's very dangerous. The heroes in those days was the Rabbi Bishlot, the Tzaddik HaDolei, was the person who wanted to grow up. That dmus, that image that he had to develop into, that he had to grow into. And that's how these children were raised in an atmosphere of religious purity. Maybe they end up in a raised atmosphere of religious orphanage, growing up as adult adolescents in a religious life. There's an enormous gap between our intellectual understanding and our religious maturity. It has been conquered. This is one of the areas where it expresses itself. The understanding that there cannot be a compensation for subjective imperfection in objective imperfection. That's the point. So I'm not perfect, therefore let me play, let me act good. Let me hang on to perfect crutches. That becomes an idolatry sort of thing. For example, this is something which again, I'm saying, you find very difficult to understand. And I believe that's one of the difficulties that our community has. Is I will not make peace with this spiritual maturity. I will not make peace with it. And I'm insisting that the people develop and grow and relate to these things in a religiously mature way, which Baruch Hashem they're doing very adequately, until they come across children very often from other communities who are not exposed to that and who are unable to relate to it in any kind of mature fashion, and that throws them off sometimes. That creates difficulties. For example, if you were to ask me, what is it the right thing for a person to learn 24 hours a day? Says the thing. The Torah says the right thing. In that case, people will say, so why do you allow people to work and to go to university to study if the right thing to learn 24 hours? What is the right thing to do? Is it the right for a person to read a good novel, but not to become a chief master? The classic movement is right. But is he a person of the Torah? Yes, he's a person of the Torah. How can I say it's right? He's got given at all. And therefore, am I then meant to say, good, nobody should read my newspaper? It's the right thing, but nobody should read it all. Is it right to read a newspaper? The newspaper's full of shaking. There's hardly a word of truth in the newspaper from the first paper until the last paper. There's hardly a word of truth. If there was any truth in it, it'd be sold. So what? So is it right to expose people to shaking? No, it isn't. It's right to expose people to shaking. Should people live in Johannesburg or should they rather live in Bnei Brak? Where's a better place to raise your children? Is a better place Yerushalayim or Bnei Brak? Is a better place Johannesburg? Of course, a better place is Yerushalayim. So why don't you tell everybody to go and live in Yerushalayim? That is the spiritual immaturity, which can't be answered to an immature person. That's a child asking a question that you can't answer in an adult fashion. That's invented by the child. What is the answer? It's what you deal with a person who has not yet got the ability to find his entertainment in turn, to find his relaxation in turn, to find his richness in turn, to expose himself to life experiences in turn. Should one ban from him all other legitimate forms, although not necessarily the most desirable or not ideal forms, but legitimate forms of entertainment and of emotional and personality enrichment? Should one say, no, since this is not ideal, you shouldn't do it? So the person comes along and says, is it ideal to read a Shakespeare play? The answer is, no, it's not ideal. If you've got the time, rather go through the Parsha once again or learn a Perek of Tanakh. That's what's ideal. So if that's what's ideal, may I or should I read a Shakespeare play? Yes, maybe you should. How can you say that if it's not? Why are you telling me to do things which are not ideal? The answer is because you're not ideal. That's why. And you're going to come much closer to an ideal by accommodating yourself to life and to situations and to slowly building yourself up to it. What do I do then 10 years later in the business? Find his fulfillment in Torah, and it's expanded, it's rich. And I came up to him, I said, you went to the shul last night. He said, I'm sorry, but I was in the middle of the Shakespeare play, I couldn't get done. What do you mean? And he says to me, but you told me 10 years ago, you told me I could do that. I could read Shakespeare, but you've grown up now. That's not anymore the case. One gets beyond that as well. That's a spiritual maturity to understand, to use life, and to use and to take as much of it as one needs and as one's family needs, to provide oneself and one's family with what one needs in order to grow, to accommodate it and to absorb it and to integrate it, all that is necessary and all that is needed if it's taken in the right way. So why should I do something which is not ideal? Because you might not. Is it right to go to learn in a kollel? Of course it's right to learn. Is it right for me to learn in a kollel at this stage of my life? Maybe yes, maybe no. How can it be no if it's the right thing, if it's ideal? How can it be right for me to do something which isn't ideal? That's what it can be. Is it ideal for Klal Yisrael to hear the Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam or from Moshe? Of course from the Ribbono Shel Olam. But they realize that if they go for that, they're going for growth. Because if they miss it, they die. It's all very well to say that the ideal thing is to go and learn in a kollel, therefore tomorrow I'm packing up and going. That's fine. But you've got to know that if you miss it, you're dead. If you don't make it there, then it's not as, okay, good, so I've got a little bit of it, but nothing. Then you've got no profession, you've got no pride, you've got no income, out on the street if you haven't made it. That's what you've got to realize. It's all very well to throw out the television and to throw out the Charles Dickens and to throw out the Shakespeare and to throw it all out because I want to live an ideal life. I can carry on with my Lashon Hara and I can carry on with my Utsar Shimro and I can carry on with my Kino and I can carry on with my Kovid and all the things. The little petty emotions which I have as a small person, fine. But I will find idealism in the objective environment which I build around me. Avodah Zarah, idolatry. That's all it is. Fine. But if you miss it, what you've got? Now you've got no exposure to life, no exposure to Torah, no exposure to anything. There's no growth anymore. That's what it's going for. Each situation has to be the subtle balance of how difficult it is to find the level and to find the balance between accommodating a non-ideal situation and striving for perfection. And the Mishnah says to Moshe Rabbeinu and Israel, in their settling for second best, have done the right thing. And why they stay that way all the time? They know their limitations, and in their desire for perfection, they have settled for second best. It's not an escape from perfection. It's in their pursuit of perfection that they're settling for second best, because that's the way they're going to get it. What's a better university? Litz or Harvard? What's a better university? Harvard is a better university. So what do you do with a kid who's just scraped through matric and his father's got endless money? So what university should he go to? Send him to Harvard? Send him to Oxford or to Cambridge? Why? Because it's the ideal, the best. But it's not the best for you. You, the best might be this. Even, it's even possible that the best is a university. What's that? Moshe didn't seem to see it this way. Because in telling this all over, Moshe uses a strange phrase. He says, "And you said to me, why should we die? Kerav ato ushma, you go forward and hear, eskol asher yom Hashem Elokeinu, whatever Hashem our God teaches you, ve'at tedaber eleinu, and you talk to us," but the at is feminine form. The at is feminine. Talk to us. Why do they use such a phrase? Why does Moshe repeat their talk in using a feminine phrase? Says Rashi, "Heitashtem es koichi kinekevo shenitzta'arti aleichem lefisem es yonah. You have weakened my strength like a female, for I have felt concerned about you, and you have weakened my hands. Ki ro'isi she'enchem charedim leizkarev elov mi'avo, because I saw you weren't extreme enough in your desire to come close to him out of love. Chi lo yoyofe lochem l'voy mi'piagur l'vodim l'vodim. You've weakened me with concern about your willingness to settle for second best. It's disappointed me to the extent that I feel weak and I feel like a fool in your willingness to be, we'll discuss that a little later, in your willingness to accept second best." So Moshe sees the perception of Moshe's weak. Moshe sees this as a terrible compromise. And the Ribbono Shel Olam sees it as one. It's not resolved in the Pasha. We don't have any form of resolution to it. Here's again a beautiful example of spiritual maturity in the way this Pasha is handled by Rav Yehuda Chasson. Rav Yehuda says the following. He asks a kasha in another Pasha. Moro says the Sanhedrin of the Tzadidah. G'nayhu l'moyshe v'shishim v'iloy sh'loy omer boruch ad sh'lo Yisrael omer boruch Hashem. It was held against Moshe and the 600,000 Jews who came after him that none of them had ever said Boruch Hashem until Yisrael, a non-Jew, came along and introduced the term. We say Boruch Hashem, where did it come from? We learned it from Yisrael. He was the one who coined the phrase Boruch Hashem. And it's held against Moshe and the 600,000 people of his time that they never said Baruch Hashem until Yisrael came out. Asks of Leib Chaskin, please, they never said Baruch Hashem. But as Yoshi and Moshe, they sang the Shira. Every single Jew, male, female, little child, sang the Shira, praising the Ribbono Shel Olam. They perceived the Ribbono Shel Olam's greatness. They perceived the Ribbono Shel Olam's Zekeli Van Vehu. Such beautiful praise in the Shira. A Shira which has been incorporated into our davening every single day we say it because of its power of phraseology, for of its enormity of praising of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Shira, they say, every Jew, every Jewess, every child, together with Moshe Rabbeinu, long before Yisrael came. But they didn't say Baruch Hashem. So is that going to be held against them? Says Rav Leib Chasson. When we talk about spiritual concepts, we can't talk about modification. There's a terrible tendency in this time to endeavor to quantify qualitative things. We can't do that. It's as ridiculous to try and quantify spiritual qualitative things as it is to use the wrong scales and measures for the wrong concepts. I say to you, how far is it from here to Pretoria? And you answer, 72 degrees Fahrenheit. It's meaningless, it's absurd. Why? What's wrong? It's a measure, and it's a kind of a measure of distance, the way it rises, the way it... That's not the way you measure distance. That's the way you measure heat. And so every dimension has its own type of scale, its own scale by which you measure it. But spirituality and quality has no scale at all. You don't measure it in quantity at all. It doesn't work with scales. Dealing with infinite, you can't say this is more infinite than this, not in degrees Fahrenheit, and not in kilograms or pounds, and not in meters or kilometers or miles. There is no way that you can talk about one thing being more spiritual than the other, or one thing being more infinite than the other, or one thing having greater quality than the other. You can talk about different qualities, but you can't talk about bigger and smaller qualities. You can't quantify quality. That's the one that Lord Haskell lays down as the principle. Therefore, he explains with that a very difficult Gemara, a Kabbalah Gemara. This gives us some kind of an insight into it. Gemara says that in the Elsid Lovo, in the world to come, the Lamed Shekol Echot the Echot, Oise Loi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chupo, Lefi Kavoyde. For every person in the world to come, the Ribbono Shel Olam creates Chupo. A special canopy. Each one has his own place, and there's a canopy that's marked out exactly where you are, and a beautiful canopy is made for you, a chuppah is made for each person. But there are various things that accompany this chuppah, and one of them is esh. And also the Gemara of fire. Esh b'chuppah lam. Why is there fire in chuppahs? Omer Rabbi Hanina Melamed, this teaches, shekol echod ve'echod Nichve Mechosu Shel Chaviv. Because every person, this teaches us that everyone is going to be burnt by the fire of his friend's chuppah. Okay. Or he goes on, how awful that embarrassment is going to be. We have to attach feelings of embarrassment to Olam Haba. We think our troubles are over once again. We got up there, we had to go through Gehenim, gone through that. Finally, we got our place in the Olam Haba. And we think we finally made it. And the Ribbono Shel Olam leads us to our chuppah and says, this is your place, which you've made for yourself. You sit down, make yourself comfortable, you're going to be spending rather a long time here. And there you go. And all of a sudden, you start feeling radiation. And you look at yourself, and you're getting all sorts of marks all over, and it's coming from everybody else's chuppah. And yours is affecting theirs. Everybody's burning each other. Says the Rashbam here, what does it mean that you're being burnt by your friend's chuppah? Everybody is being burnt, every smaller person is being burnt by a chuppah more powerful than theirs, bigger than theirs. Being burnt by each other. Asks you, Leib Chasman, what does it mean everybody? Then it should say, Tani are burnt by the chuppahs of Gedolim. What does it mean? Kul echod the echod. Every single human being is going to be burnt by the chuppah of his friends. Says Reb Leib Chasman, that even means the biggest godel and the biggest tzaddik that ever lived is going to be burnt by the chuppahs of others. How come? What can he be burnt by? Says Reb Leib Chasman, spiritual matters. Quality number 100 doesn't include all the other 99. It's all different. And each person is individual, each person is unique. And what I have achieved and excelled is different to what somebody else has. The fact that he might be greater than me does not mean that I don't have certain qualities which he doesn't have. In halacha, we have a principle of bichlal nosai monim. Included in 200 is 100. You don't have to specify if you're talking about a 100 and you're using a 200 rand note, you don't have to get change. You can use a 200 rand note because it contains the 100 rand in it. But not so in spirituality. 200 does not contain the 100 necessarily. 200 is one concept, and 100 is another, and 300 is another, and they have no way of being compared. They only compare identical things, and in each identical factor which goes up to it, which goes into making up the totality of my spiritual personality, I can compensate this particular quality. Do I have it or don't I have it? Does somebody else have it or doesn't? If I don't and somebody else does, the somebody else might be much junior to me, but still I'm going to feel terrible pain. In fact, the greater I am, the more I'll feel pain that somebody junior to me has these qualities which I didn't develop. that you see, says Reb Leib, but being great doesn't mean you're going to escape the embarrassment of being exposed by the greatness of smaller people than you. You can be exposed by the greatness of smaller people than you, because when you're talking about spiritual greatness, the most wonderful praise, the most potent praise, the most all-embracing praise, and the little two words which Israel used, Ol Hashem, weren't included in the Shira. And as great as the Shira is, the fact that it's great doesn't mean that it contains that as well. It doesn't necessarily contain that as well. It's great, but it's in a sense, it can't be compared. Yisro came with Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem is not as great as the Shira. It's different. And the fact is, nobody said Baruch Hashem. They said other things, they said greater things, they said better things. But in spiritual things, bigger does not include small. And you can't get away with it and say, but I did even better than that. There's no such thing. What you did was different. It's not the same. Anybody who's a collector of precious things understands that. Imagine a person who collects precious diamonds and he's got a perfect 5 carats. I don't know what you call the thing. The blue one. Flawless. What else? D-flawless. What's better than D they don't have? And what else? What color? Blue. D is the color. D, flawless, 5-carat he's managed to find. Absolutely fantastic. Somebody else brings him afterwards an E, flawless, 4-carat. What's he going to say? No thanks, I've got better than that. He got better, but this is different. It's like a different color. It looks different. It's a slightly different cat. Of course he wants to add it to his collection. Talking quality. The one doesn't cancel out the other. If somebody has a $3 million Van Gogh and is offered another Van Gogh that's only $2 million, what's he going to say? I've got the $3 million one, I don't need the $2 million one. Of course I need the two. It's different, it's not included. When you're talking with qualities, the one does not include the other. Each has to be seen on its own. Therefore, says Reb Leib Chassman, both the Ribbono Shlom and Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, right. Moshe Rabbeinu says, in your desire to take second best. I was so disappointed. When Shlomo says, your desire to take second best was so great, so outstanding in Yerushalayim. Both are right, says Rebbe Kasper. If you are spiritually mature, you don't have difficulty finding these conflicts within one concept. One can look at an E flawless and say, only an E flawless. Why is the D? And one can look at the E flawless and say, that means that D-flawless isn't better. It's not a question of better or not. Which one is different? And therefore it is possible within the same action to find aspects which are precious beyond valuation, infinitely precious, and yet to find other aspects which are not as they feel. That's the nature of life. It's infinite. One can't knock a couple of points off. It's not this or it's not that. One doesn't knock each thing has to be appreciated for itself for what it is. And there it's important in our whole valuation of people to understand this principle. If we're looking at people, we can't measure them. We can't measure people. We try to do that. We try to measure people by their labels. We try to measure people by their objective things. And that's how we try to put them into categories. We can't do that. If you really have to be that as a component quality. Such his value is it. And he needs to be appreciated, not measured. That's the enormous difference between appreciating something and measuring something. If you're measuring it, you already know you're not in the appreciation. When that American asked how much does Versailles cost, he's out of the realm of appreciation and is into the realm of value. It's different. To value something, to measure something, is not to appreciate it. You're dealing with qualities. If you're dealing with qualities, you've got to understand this is a big measure. We use the term, we say it's priceless. So forget about how much it is, just enjoy it. You have a good look at the majority, you don't have to appreciate what it is. You don't have to measure it. We're dealing with human beings and with human values, and that's so important. That's important. Also, defining how one can compliment without flattering. What flatters a person if one's compliment is insincere, and if one's complimenting for things which he doesn't possess. But it is still possible to compliment anybody to the heavens, even if he's inadequate in so many areas. This is something different. precious event, incarnation. It's also a very important mechanism in the development of security, which is part of that maturity we're talking about. That spiritual maturity is the understanding that I am working something. That whatever I do and I don't do, and although I could be better, that's measured, that's something else. But in terms of appreciation, I'm infinite, I'm in a shalom. And the little bit of Yerushalayim that I've got is infinitely valuable. And that needs to be appreciated. Therefore, I don't need to measure myself against others. I need to only measure myself in terms of my own striving, my own improving. It's not necessary, necessary constantly to be measuring myself against others. I can feel satisfied within myself when I realize that whatever I've got is infinite. However little it is, it's infinite. So what are we measuring? Infinite. Infinite. You're more infinite than I. Is that what we're saying? When we're talking about priceless things, are we going to start discussing about which is more priceless than the other? There is no such thing. So we're going to talk about whose Yerushalayim is more, and what individual, if we're involved in the qualities of Yerushalayim, then there's no measure. You don't measure one against the other. Each is a gem, there to be appreciated, not to be measured. Of course, if we're involved in the Christianity of Yerushalayim, we're involved in the objective side of Yiddishkeit, that it's easy to measure. Where do you get your meat? And what should you get your meat? And how much do you pay for your little nursery? And do you have a television in your house or don't you? And what school do you send your children to? Because that's 105 on the scale of Yiddishkeit. No, you're not good enough for me, because I've got 162 on my scale. Therefore, it's a different thing altogether. I'm from the view. Gee, whoo, wow, my goodness, you really are from. It's just so childish. What are we dealing with? We're dealing with measuring instead of appreciation. Instead of understanding. There are things which are just beyond calculation. You can't waste time trying to calculate. That's not where the preciousness is to be found. The preciousness is to be found in their appreciation of the preciousness. It's all about measuring. Why Moshe was doing this measuring? Moshe was saying, you could have got more. That's measuring. But Moshe was saying it's infinite. I don't care what they could have. What they've got is infinite, and I would be happy with it if they could retain that always. It would be good enough. And Moshe is saying you could have more. You could have more is measurement. There is a very big difference. Let's, before we talk about the difference, let's understand the place of measurement. Is there a place for measurement? Should we cut it out altogether? The hippies of the 1960s have cut it out altogether. It's not important. There is no objective value to anything. You can't measure anything. Nothing is can be standardized. There's no right and wrong way to write, for example, form. There's no right and wrong way to dress. There's no right and wrong way to speak. Grammar is not important. You've just got to feel and say what you feel and be spontaneous. We're dealing with infinite things, all very existential. The first part of the shiur that I've given up for now, very existential, very hippish. It's all very up in the air, and it's nice and spiritual, and don't measure anything, all is fine. But is that really so? Is there not a place for measure? Is there not a time when one has to say to oneself, I mean, could be more, could be better? And say, not measure against somebody else. Maybe against myself, could be more, but then I'm measuring the real. There it is. And again, coming to spiritual maturity. Spiritual maturity is the correct balance between measuring and appreciating. I've emphasized the appreciation because we're living in a very materialistic world. In this materialistic world, what is emphasized is the measurement. So to counter that, for the last 50 minutes or so, I've been emphasizing appreciating rather than measuring. Maturity lies in knowing how to use both correctly. Transactional analysis, you will have heard, they talk about the different parts of personality, and they talk about the parents' personality. It's a part of all of us which we acquire from our parents. And it's a part which is a childish part of our personality, all very important. And it's a part which they call the adult part of the personality, all very important, and all have a role to play. But what I'm interested in at the moment is the area they call the parent part. The parent part they divide into two. They call the one the critical parent, and they call the other the nurturing parent. To be critical, you need measurements. To be critical, you have to have some measurements, and you have to be able to say to yourself, I haven't measured up. To be nurturing, you go to bed and not measure. Comes the child home from school, and he's tried really hard. And he's really put a lot of work in. you encounter with the question you asked when you went to study, and the exam didn't go so well. He wasn't feeling so well that day either, but he really did try hard. He tried harder than he ever tried before, and his marks are better than they've ever been before. But instead of getting 18% and coming on top of the class, he only got 64%. Now what is wrong? So you come back and say, critical thing, 64% my child, that's not good. 80% is where you're aiming, you didn't get to where you're aiming. Never will be the class. It doesn't matter, you try hard, you pass, that's all that's important, next time you'll also do better. That's useful, but you have to. If you abandon the measurement, and if you forget about the standards, then the child will never achieve anything in all his life. There are people, I think all of us have a bit of it, unless we have a great deal of emphasis on our child in measuring, who are running on a treadmill. They're working and working and working, but they never really get anything. They're working hard, but they never make anything. They're learning their Gemara, but they never know a sukkah. They're studying for exams and always studying, but they never really quite make it. You can't fault them on laziness. They really work, but they never make it. They never just think, why? Because they were always raised with children, it doesn't matter as long as you try. So they try. And they know they don't have to achieve because their parents never expected them. As long as they were trying, it was okay. So they go through their lives trying, and they are successful triers who always fail. That's the one. I'm giving you the extreme example. I think we all have a little bit of it in ourselves. But there's some people who have it very chronically. That they really work and they're putting in effort and they're going and they never make it. There has to be critical part that says that's just not good. On the other hand, if there was only that, we would be completely. Then we cease to appreciate that there's no culture, there's no civilization, there's no value system. And all that's important is results. Then you can kill and you can murder and you can lie in order to get to the top. You can walk over people, you can do what you want, because all that matters is the results, my friend. I don't care how hard you tried, I want to know, did you get there or didn't you get there? That's all that's important. You got your 80%, you didn't get your 80%. You made your million or you haven't made your million. That's all that's important. So we find that either extreme is going to cause an imbalanced personality. We're either going to have a person who's always trying and never makes it, or we're going to have a person who makes it, but who makes it with brutality. Who makes it by losing his measurement. Therefore, we need to be raised with both and we need to operate with both. On the one hand, we need a voice saying, this is not good. Better. 80% is what you set out to achieve and you failed. You only got 79.5. That's failure. The measuring part of us has to regard 79.5 as failure if the aim was 80. You've got to be very careful in setting your aim. Your aim has to be realistic. If you've decided that 80 is my aim, then 79.5 is total failure. And there has to be a part of you that says that's just no good. You failed. Try again. And there has to be another part of you that says, but that's no reason to be. You failed only by 0.5%, and a little bit more effort, you can make it, you will make it, you try again, you try, improving, you get it, the trouble is, take the child, how do you do this to the child? The father comes and says, you're going to write your exam today, my boy, 80% or don't come. He gets 79%, and he sneaks in. And he sneaks in through the back door. The father finds him at night. How much did you get? It's a 79.5%. Oh, that's awesome. Next week, another test coming in. The father says 80%. What is the child's aim? 79.5% will be an answer. The child only gets 78%. Comes home, how much did he get? Yeah, it's also right. Try hard, my boy. It doesn't matter. You get an answer. Goes into his next exam. The father says 80% or you don't come home. What does the child say? Ah, probably 60%. Comes home with 60%, works hard, tries it, 60%, comes home, father says, okay, it's not what I wanted, it's alright, don't matter, we'll still go out to the next. So what are the standards? The child has no standards. How do you handle this? Rebbeinu Shlomo has a magnificent technique. He gave a child two parents. Father measures, mother values. So you don't have to measure. Father will never settle for less than 80%. child will get upset. The mother will help the child cope with that. You have failed, but don't worry. You'll do better next time. Not you haven't failed. She doesn't undermine the father. You have failed. But don't worry, my child. It'll be okay. We'll help you. We'll show your father next time. You can get him next time. Demands of him because of how much he values you and he knows that you can. And the father still says 80% or nothing, and we're not going out, we're cancelling the movies tonight, didn't make you 80%, that's it. And the child's crying and crying. And the mother doesn't say, no, it's okay, we'll go to the movies. No, the mother helps the child over that disappointment. You manage, okay, next time we'll do something better than going to the movies. Much bigger treat than that is done. Don't you worry. He did in the lady's shoe. It's a very tragic king toward the end of Malachim. Yeshayahu is his name. Yeshayahu grew up without Torah. To the best of his ability, he tried to lead a good kingdom, but during his reign, a Torah was discovered. It was a period where the Torah was all destroyed, and he just didn't know what was right and what was wrong. He was raised without Torah. And a Torah was discovered, and he starts reading in the Torah. He realizes all sorts of things that he hasn't done right, and he tries to correct them in the best way possible. And one of the things he does is he sends his men to Huldo the Nevi to ask for her advice, to ask her to pray for the Mishnah, to ask her to forgive them for having done wrong, and to guide them as to how to do right. So, ask the Midrash a very wonderful question. First, the Midrash asks, Yirmiyahu was alive. What right did Huldah have to prophesy in the presence of Yirmiyahu? She should have sent them to Yirmiyahu. So the Midrash answers. Then the Midrash asks, Yoshiyahu kufehechi habishovik? Yirmiyahu v'shodah legabo? Good. I understand how Huldah was entitled to prophesy and to lead. But why did Yoshiyahu send his men to Huldah when Yirmiyahu is over there? Surely he should have gone to Yirmiyahu? He was a greater prophet, if one can talk about greater, that's great. Amri the Bey Rav Shila, they answered in the house of Rav Shila, it's not a question of great, more great than this kind, it's people. She was a woman. Noshim Rachmanis, woman of the sea, and that's a woman of the sea. It's a feminine quality, it's a separation. It's a big difference between men and women. As I point out in the Lady Shir, the word Rachamim comes from the root Rech, which is a woman. Is where the childhood needs to protect it from the outside, nurture it, not to grow. Don't worry about the little world outside. So, well, okay, my child, I'll digest the food for you. I'll take the shocks for you. If I'm bumped or I fall, my body will take the impact. You'll be protected. I will integrate life for you until you come out of the womb. The woman is designed to cushion her children. She's given the middle of racham. Rachamim is empathy, sympathy, the ability to cushion another person from the hard knocks of life. There's a man is called a geber, which comes from the word gevura. There's strength, uncompromising, measuring, this is it, nothing else, there's no cushioning, there's no settling the second best, that's it. That's how it's going to be. Moshe Rabbeinu felt that they were wrong to choose second best. What does he say? A strange phrase. Hitashtem eskrichi kinekeim. You made me weak like a man. Feminine sex is called the weaker sex. And that's a compliment. That's not a modern sexist terminology. It's regarded as an insult. The thing that he sees particularly is for women to take on physically demanding jobs to show there's no difference. They can also do it. Compliment. That weakness comes from their whole design, which is made to sympathize with them. A person who doesn't have weakness can't sympathize with them. A person who's hard on himself and who has uncompromising principles which he cannot do, which a woman is not prepared to accommodate or to deviate from at all. A person who doesn't know what it is not to be able to do something. A very simple example in physical terms, but it works spiritually and it works emotionally and it works mentally. For a man to pick up a heavy object is not so difficult. It's fit, it works, his body's in good condition, he picks it up, it's okay. Comes the little boy and he says, they screw the table from there to there. He tells his little 6 year old, she was trying, he says, come on, I said, move the table! And she says, this table, it's not so easy, come, I'll help you. Why is he so intolerant? She knows our existence. She's weak also. That is for her rahmanas, for her to understand and empathize with the inability of others, she needs to know what it is to find something hard and to find something difficult. For the man's guru, he mustn't. It is manly to be strong. It is masculine to be strong physically and emotionally and mentally. That is the masculine thing to be able to take it. And for a woman, it's feminine not to be quite so strong. Not to find it more difficult, because that helps her empathize. I don't think women have difficulties and bad problems. It helps her empathize with the truth. Because Moshe, I wasn't angry with you. Moshe doesn't say, Kumban Kutsati Olechem. He says, Litzno Altia. I felt sorry for what he looks. I've got to help. I'm not criticizing the future for choosing certain things. I'm just saying how much better it would have been had you been able to get best. I understand you didn't get 80%. I understand you've only got 60% and therefore you can't go to Yale, you've got to settle with this. And I've got to comfort you. But the energy it's taking from me to comfort you is turning me into a female. I've got to empathize and sympathize with inability, with inadequacy. And that's weakening me. But it's not weakening me in a negative sense, it's weakening me like that. I've become feminine. By caring for your inadequacies. So we see that there is not really a conflict in perception between the Ribbono Shel Olam and Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the same perception from slightly different angles. Both see that the choice was right, but since they were not ideal people and could not be ideal people permanently, they had to settle for a less than ideal situation. They had to settle for Moshe and not for the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that was right. They couldn't go for broke. They dare not go for broke. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I accept that, it's right, it's good. Says Moshe, yes, it's right, it's good. I'm going to have a point of view, loss of what you could have had if you were better. And that's good for me. That sorrow, that pain and suffering that I've got to feel with you is good for me. There we have it. That's all part of the spiritual maturity. And the emotional maturity, understanding that there are different parts. There's the measuring adult, there's the critical adult, there's the nurturing adult, the nurturing parent. But one needs the guru, one needs the racham. One needs to sympathize and empathize but without sacrificing one's standards. One needs to measure, but measuring must not detract from valuing and appreciating. One must develop the capacity to appreciate and yet not allow appreciation to obliterate the rigidity of measurements as well. And then the immature person comes along and says, but which is right? You must measure or you must appreciate? Which is right? Maturity means blending. Maturity means synthesizing. Using them both simultaneously. Understanding when it's the appropriate time and when it's the appropriate situation to use the one and not the other. A child bursts out crying. So you can't have another apple. A child bursts out crying. So the child's not crying. And then a few months later, the child sees an ovel cemetery and cry. He's an adult, he's allowed to cry. Why do you say I was a child because I was crying? To cry for cemetery is appropriate. To cry when you can't have another apple is inappropriate. Maturity is using the appropriate reactions and responses to the correct situations. It doesn't mean that crying is wrong. It means that crying at the wrong time is childish. So it is with all these things. Being critical and measuring when you need to appreciate and value is childish. Appreciating when you need to be measuring is childish. Maturity lies in knowing when to set standards and when to appreciate and when to value. It's learning to see the two together. Yishkat, we've got two clearly defined areas. There's the area of halacha, which is very much an area of measurement. It's a correct way and an incorrect way. There's sometimes a hair's breadth between. Halacha deals primarily with areas of measurement. Halacha can be measured. That's the halacha. Then there's the Yerushalayim. The Yerushalayim is the atmosphere in which the halacha is kept. The quality that's given to the halacha, the feeling that's given to the halacha, the sanctity that's given to the halacha, it can't be measured. Each one is immeasurable. Each one is infinite. And so in every one of our actions, there is a combination of the measurable and the immeasurable. Careful not to confuse the two. It comes along and has a time against somebody who doesn't need kosher meat. It's fine. It's a time. It's that measurable thing which is not in order. It's a quantitative thing which is measured by halacha, it's not doing it correctly. you see somebody in tshuva, his tefillin is not in the correct place. The tefillin is over his ears, really between his eyes. The tefillin is the wrong place, it needs to be here. He says, don't be silly, what's the difference? As long as a Rachmana Liba boy, the Rishon wants heart, it doesn't matter. What difference does it make for the Rishon? He knows I mean it well. There's a time to, for meaning, there's a time for measurement. The tefillin has to be in the right place. One has to put it in the right place. That's fine. But that can't be the condition. In addition to that, the condition. One has to be careful, just as one must not attach appreciation to areas which need measurement. And one mustn't say, well, this tefillin are possible and they're over his ear, so it doesn't matter. He means well. You can't say that. So in matters of Yerushalayim, you mustn't try to measure. You mustn't try to attach objective measurements. If it's out of the area of absolute halacha, then one has to appreciate it for what it is. You don't look and see whether there's a television in the house or not. You look and see how the person uses the television. Is he addicted to it? Or does he watch it only for what is necessary? You don't say, does he have a Shakespeare in his house or he doesn't have a Shakespeare? That's not a measure of Yerushalayim. Measure of Yerushalayim is when he reads a piece of Shakespeare, does he extract his sodas from it and criticize where it needs criticism and accept where it needs acceptance, or does he read it blindly and he has no tools with which to handle it? When he reads a newspaper, does he just accept what he reads, or does he know how to detect the shaker in it? Does he know how to handle it? When he deals with the lates, as we had earlier, does he know how to deal with the lates, or doesn't he know how to deal with the lates? Don't try and attach objective measurements to areas that need appreciation and need them. There we have to appreciate one another and ourselves infinitely, and to understand that there's no such thing as one thing being more infinite than another. There's no such thing as one person being any more Yerushalayim than another. Two people have Yerushalayim in different ways. Each one is valued. Within ourselves, of course, we aim to improve ourselves. We aim to settle for nothing but the best. We have to be at the same time understanding that the heaven we have got is worth an absolute eternity to live in Yerushalayim.